This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Lobbyists in charge. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
An investigation finds that each year, lawmakers at the state level introduce thousands of bills written by corporations. Then they're copied and used by other state capitals.
On the personal finance front, lessons from recent stock market crashes.
It's a Masters weekend. Here are six bizarre facts about Augusta, including where the clubs get the sand for its bunkers.
And baby boomers who skip the young hotshot trainer in favor of one with a little more gray around the temples.
It was more of a reluctance. It's just that, you know, they know they want to work out, they want to stay active, but the idea of working out with someone who's 25 and just has no concept of what it really is like when your body ages just gave people pause.
Wall Street Journal reporter Hillary Potkowitz on rising demand for trainers in their 50s and 60s. She's here in about 20 minutes. Each year, state lawmakers across the U.S. introduce thousands of bills dreamed up and written by corporations, industry groups, and think tanks. Disguised as the work of lawmakers, these so-called model bills get copied in one state capital after another. A two-year investigation by USA Today, the Arizona Republic, and the Center for Public Integrity reveals for the first time the extent to which special interests have infiltrated state legislatures using model legislation. In all, USA Today investigations editor Chris Davis says these copycat bills amount to the nation's largest unreported special interest campaign, driving agendas in every state house and touching nearly every area of public policy. Chris, what happens here?
So what happens is corporations, special interest groups, industry groups, they write from scratch their own laws, bills, and they go to lawmakers in friendly state houses and they pitch them and have them introduce them, and these things spread from one state house to the next and ultimately can change policy across the country.
Boy, 10,000 bills almost entirely copied from model legislation were introduced nationwide.
That's right. It was a shocking number to us. It's also important to keep in mind that it's a bare minimum number, because the matching that we did relied on bills compared to model bills that were nearly exact. So these don't even count sort of the smaller strings of text that might get a corporation what it wants, but just takes a couple of sentences to describe. There's probably far more of this than we even know.
Were there certain lobby groups that seem to be, for lack of a better term, better at this than others?
You know, the big player is ALEC, which is a conservative group that's gotten some press over the years, and they continue to be the group that has the most success. They have a really refined mechanism to get these bills introduced and passed, and it relies on these conferences that they have that bring together wealthy interests, corporations, and otherwise to meet with lawmakers. And these guys sit down in committees and hash out laws together and then often take them back to their home states and introduce them or put them in the hands of lobbyists around the country so they can be introduced in other states.
Mm. We're speaking with Chris Davis, executive editor for Investigations at USA Today. They've put together a piece entitled, "You Elected Them to Write Laws, They're Letting Corporations Do It Instead." You mentioned, too, some of these bills have deceptive titles. Like what?
Well, there's a bill that we featured in the story about called the Asbestos Transparency Act, and this was just one of a number of examples that we found. It sounds like a bill that might help people who get sick from asbestos, or might help you avoid products that have asbestos in them. But this was a bill that was crafted directly by companies that are under the gun to pay people who have been injured, killed, gotten sick from exposure to asbestos. And so it sounds like something that might be consumer-oriented, but what it's really there for is to limit how much money folks who have been sick or have died from asbestos exposure can get by suing companies.
Wow. How about some of these suspect experts too that weigh in on these things?
Yeah, that's another thing that we found as we went through these is that lawmakers either don't realize or realize and don't bother to tell anyone that experts offered up by organizations like ALEC or other lobbyists actually have ties back to the companies and the entities that are writing these bills. And so the folks who are writing the language all have their own agenda. Those agendas could be good or they could be it could be a profit motive, and we don't really know. And then you have the people who are advocating for the bill as if they are experts on a topic are actually coming from the groups that are writing the bills for their own purposes.
How about the states that copy the most? I know you had a big chart on this. What are the takeaways there?
Yeah, I think you see what you would kind of expect, that conservative states tend to have more conservative models introduced, and liberal states tend to have more liberal models introduced. Mississippi stands out as the place where we found the most model bills. A relatively small state where a lot of this activity is happening. Mississippi doesn't necessarily pass the most model bills, but they do seem to be kind of an incubator for trying to get traction when these groups are trying to expand on an idea. So it's interesting. The tactic seems to in part be just to get this on people's radars, and there seems to be a value even if the bills don't pass in getting the issue out in the public, allowing lawmakers to kind of make a statement that here's where I stand on this conservative or liberal issue. And then, of course, they've established a relationship with someone who might want to give them money to be reelected.
Thanks, Chris. That is Chris Davis, investigations editor at USA Today. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. According to the Department of Veterans Affairs, 20 veterans take their own lives every day. And earlier this month, President Trump signed an executive order to ramp up efforts to prevent veteran suicide. How can the rest of us help starting today? We're joined now by retired Army Major John Reddy of Oneida, New York. 21 years in the Army National Guard and Reserves and was deployed to Iraq as a civil affairs officer. John, set this up.
Well, the VA is putting out figures like 20 veterans per day committing suicide on the average. And the community, because as someone put it, I can't remember who said this, but they said, if you voted, if you pay taxes, and you're a citizen of this country, you're part of the mechanism that sends these young men and women into harm's way. So we have a responsibility as a community to welcome them back into society and they have this big divide between military / veterans and the civilians. So what I wrote about in my book are all the weird things that I experienced, my soldiers experienced, in addition to the tragic. A lot of people have asked me, how many people did you kill? Which is like the worst thing you can ask a veteran.
Geez.
But it happens a lot, okay? If I had a dollar for every time somebody asked me, I could turn away my pension, which I'm not going to do.
Is that right?
Yeah, and that's like the worst thing you can ask a veteran, because they may or may not have had to do that. But when you say, thank you for your service, that's the first step. Because you're acknowledging, even subconsciously, that that person didn't pick or choose where they went, where they fought, where they served, who they served with. And short of outright murder or a violation of the Geneva Convention, everything that is done in our name as a member, as a country. And I think a lot of people have gotten away from.
Why is there that divide that you described?
Only 1%, they said only 1% of the American population serves any one given time. So that's a big disconnect. A lot of people don't have the same experiences. I mean, other than some kind of trauma, like unfortunately like rape or a car accident, not a lot of people have the same experiences with have to be away from their families for that long, for like a year or more than a year. I only did one tour, and that was enough for me. I only did one deployment. These kids are doing multiple deployments.
Yeah.
And also, you got these 18, 19, 20-year-old kids who, in the military, in their service, they have a lot of responsibility, and they have a certain level of prestige among their peers in the military. And when they're not in the military anymore, that's all gone. They're like Joe Citizen, who might be, you know, a 21-year-old kid who's unemployed now.
Right. So on that note, how do you fix that? Because that's an important issue.
Well, there's got to be more job creation for veterans. And I know that the government's trying to do its best to hire more veterans. But also, I think it's the community, instead of asking, like, how many people did you kill? Just ask them, like, where did you serve? What branch of the military were you in? Do you still keep in touch with your buddies that you serve with? How bad was the food? Because that's something everybody can get together on, with, like, you know, bad food. And when you're asking the questions, and they want to talk about the good stuff that happened, the pride that they have in their what they did and their service. When you ask them to open up, you're subconsciously, I believe, welcoming them back into the fold.
We're speaking with Major John Reddy, U.S. Army retired. We're talking about how to help a veteran. He's also written a book called Does My Suicide Vest Make Me Look Fat? I know there have been some efforts, too, to hire veterans specifically among different companies and stuff. Is that helping?
Yeah, that's helping. Veterans want nothing more than to be part of, like, a bigger cause, you know, like they were in the military, like supporting or serving for a higher cause or being a protector. So I think hiring as many veterans as possible and giving them veterans preference, which is like prevalent now. But I also believe that veterans are tough to open up or to seek help from government agencies because they feel like they're going to be stigmatized, like, oh, you know, how many people did you kill? Or they don't want to take medications. They don't trust. Maybe something happened where they don't trust the government.
Thanks, John. Retired Army Major John Reddy. It is 22 minutes after the hour on this weekend. Thanks for joining us. Demand for older personal trainers is on the rise nationwide as baby boomers hit the gym looking to stay in shape, recover from surgery, or just improve their physical fitness. While many older gym members are eager exercises, some are reluctant to put themselves at the mercy of a younger trainer. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
Forget the hotshot personal trainer with the six-pack abs. Boomers are looking for fitness coaches who match their profiles better. Hillary Potkowitz of the Wall Street Journal has written a story about the latest fitness trend and has more. Hillary, let's start by looking at the number of older people working out. Is it increasing?
Yes. You know, it looks like the number of people aged 55 or older, number of gym members aged 55 or older, has increased from around 8.6 million in 2006 to a decade later in 2016 to 13.5 million. So that's a huge jump.
Now, Hillary, why did you find that some of these folks want older trainers?
Sure. What I mostly found was that people, it was more of a reluctance. It's just that, you know, they know they want to work out, they want to stay active, but the idea of working out with someone who's 25 and just has no concept of what it really is like when your body ages just gave people pause. You know, there was some people said, oh, they're going to kill me, or people have had rough experiences in the past where they explained their concerns to a young trainer and then found that after they worked out, they actually, you know, had injuries, or they had to go to the doctor, or they had a pinched nerve, or just things that just felt like they weren't really heard.
Hillary, are trainers themselves getting older? Are there enough of those people to match the boomers who are working out?
It's definitely a sort of a new growth area. Middle-aged trainers or mature trainers, trainers of a certain age, however you want to phrase it, are definitely in the minority. I mean, most of the places I spoke to had, you know, a handful of trainers, you know, 45 or older. It's definitely traditionally been like a young person's game, I guess. But now there are definitely more opportunities for older trainers as gym members or even as health club owners are noticing
that their members really gravitate towards trainers who are kind of their contemporaries, or at least in like a similar generation.
We're speaking with Hillary Potkowitz of the Wall Street Journal. Hillary, how do health club operators react to this whole thing?
It was funny. You know, a lot of them said, well, you know, it's not like members come and ask us and say, oh, I want a trainer who's, you know, 55 years old. But everyone that I talked to said that the moment they hired a trainer who was maybe in their late 40s or 50s or even 60s, that the person was instantly popular. And all of the older, quote, trainers that I spoke to said that every time they go out on the gym floor, people, they're like a magnet. People of their age, you know, baby boomers, people of their similar generation, just gravitate to them and say, hey, would you be willing to, you know, do you take more clients? Do you want to work one-on-one? Or they have questions, or they have, you know, concerns. I have arthritis in my toe, or whatever it is, like individual aches and pains and things that just happen as you get older. People, I guess, seem more comfortable talking to someone who they are confident has gone through it or knows what they're talking about, rather than someone who maybe has studied it or like tries to imagine what it's like to be older, but who just by virtue of being, you know, in their 20s can't possibly really know what it's like.
And I would imagine it's a little bit lucrative for the health club operators as well, because these folks might have a little more money than people in their 20s.
It can be. I mean, the health club industry's personal training as a job, as a career, has a very high burnout rate. Almost, you know, more than 15% of personal trainers leave the industry every year. So gyms are constantly dealing with turnover. And it looks like so far the gym operators that I've spoken to said that their trainers who they hire as, you know, in the second career, sort of the middle-aged trainers who have had other work experience, seem to stick around longer. Again, unscientific, but, you know, everyone that I've talked to said, oh, you know what, actually, the older trainers I've hired are still here.
Wall Street Journal reporter Hillary Potkowitz with this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal, Jennifer Koschenka. Coming up this half hour, lessons from modern stock market crashes. Also, the fine art of good and bad storytelling. And weird facts about the Masters. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Just how American is your American-made vehicle? The Detroit Three car makers for years have built some vehicles in other countries that they sell in the United States. With President Trump having run against the nation's trade deficit and vowing to rebuild American manufacturing jobs, the practice has faced renewed criticism. That was magnified last November when General Motors announced plans to idle three North American assembly plants in Michigan and Ohio. Last year, 47% of the vehicles sold in the U.S. were imported. Of those built and sold in the U.S., a little more than half were Detroit Three cars. Jamie LaRue at the Detroit Free Press did some analysis. Jamie, what have you found?
There's been a lot of controversy in the news lately because General Motors has talked about idling five of their plants in North America in endangering about 6,200 jobs. And so they've come under intense scrutiny from President Trump to local lawmakers as well as UAW workers for idling those plants. And one of the big complaints that the UAW has had and President Trump has had is that General Motors builds a lot of vehicles in Mexico. And they've upped their production in Mexico, putting in some new SUV production there, and they've shifted some production of their pickup trucks to Mexico. GM is now the biggest car maker in Mexico. They've surpassed Nissan in terms of the number of vehicles that they build and export from Mexico.
Is there actually a vehicle that is made completely in the United States?
You know, interesting you should ask that. If you look at cars.com, they will often do, they'll kind of dissect that, and they'll look at all the cars out there from all the automakers, and they will compile which vehicle has the most domestic parts in terms of its content, where it's built, and how many it's sold, and kind of comes up with a list of what is the most American car. And ironically, it has been the Toyota Camry. Has been number one for a while when you factor in all that. It's built in Georgetown, Kentucky, and a lot of its components are also made in domestic plants. So, I mean, but beyond that, I know I've seen the Jeep Cherokee, I believe, that vehicle has a large component of it that comes from suppliers in the United States as well as being built in Belvidere, Illinois.
What were some of the stats that jumped out at you as you were pulling all this together?
I think just the fact that, you know, when you look at the number of vehicles built in Canada and Mexico that are sold here, 43% of them are Detroit brands. I thought it might be a little bit higher than that. You know, that kind of jumped out at me. And also the fact that in the case of Ford, about 80 to 82% of the vehicles that it sells in the U.S. are actually built at U.S. factories. That's pretty high.
Yeah.
You know, when you consider the amount of vehicles that they could build elsewhere.
Mm. We're speaking with Jamie LaRue, business writer at the Detroit Free Press, about her piece entitled "Your Domestic Vehicle May Not Be Made in America. Here's Where They're Built." How about the role of Brazil here? I know you referenced that country.
Yeah, Brazil has not, there's been investment by GM in terms of its plants in Brazil. They don't export a lot of vehicles that are built in Brazil and sell them here. But they have invested $2.7 billion in two of the plants that they have in Brazil. It'll create some 400 jobs, you know, that has riled some of their critics. Particularly the GM hourly workers in North America who are facing losing their jobs in terms of the plants that GM wants to idle. They have done that, and they've, I think, received some tax benefits from the local government in Brazil in doing that, in making that decision.
Thanks, Jamie. Jamie LaRue at the Detroit Free Press. It is 21 minutes now in front of the hour. On this weekend, there's something about the massive hemorrhaging of money that has a way of focusing the mind and sticking in the memory. Personal finance expert Jonathan Clements says he's among those who gets more pain from losses than pleasure from gains, which might explain why he often thinks back on the major market crashes that have occurred during his investing lifetime. He learned lessons from each. Jonathan, what'd you do in this piece?
Article, what I did is I looked back over my 33 years writing and thinking about money, and I thought about the five major market crashes that have occurred during my investing lifetime. And the first and earliest was, of course, Black Monday. I think anybody who was around on Black Monday, October 19th, 1987, will never forget that day. You know, the S&P 500 plunged more than 20%, and it really was a classic panic. I mean, there were immediately, you know, there were parallels drawn to 1929, but in many ways, it wasn't 1929, as we now know in retrospect. I mean, first, anybody who panicked on the day the market declined was pretty much getting out of the market low. We got the entire decline almost in one day.
Yeah, right.
But two is, in the aftermath of October 19th, all the commentators were harping on the possibility of a recession. And for a lot of people, that talk that we were going to have a recession and possibly even a depression kept them from investing. And, of course, they missed out on the sharp rebound in the market that we saw through the rest of 1987 into 88 and even into 89. I mean, there was a big gains in those that subsequent period. They were missed by people who were scared out of the market by all the talk about recession.
You know what I thought was interesting, too? You said that on Black Monday 1987, you didn't have any money invested. You're only 24 years old, but that did not frighten you, I guess, from eventually getting in, obviously.
No, absolutely not. I only wish that I'd got in sooner. I actually was working at Forbes magazine at the time, and on the third floor of the building, they had one of those old Dow Jones tickers where, you know, sort of like, you know, light brown toilet paper kicking out of a machine.
Yeah.
People would stand around that machine all day on Black Monday, waiting for the latest read on the Dow and how much the market was falling. We all knew the market was falling because the reporting on stock prices was so slow that day. It wasn't until the market closed that people knew exactly how far the Dow had plunged.
Yeah. We're speaking with Jonathan Clements. He's the founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. What did you take away from what you call the tech wreck, late 90s?
Yeah, well, the late 1990s was a baffling time. We had all these new technology companies, you know, going public, and I, for one, didn't really understand what all these companies did. I mean, it was all brand new, and I believe a lot of other people were equally ignorant about exactly what these companies were doing, but the difference was they were happy to buy them. And in many ways, I think that people are happy to buy stuff that they don't really understand because they think that, well, if I don't understand it, this has got to be really clever and sophisticated, and it's going to make me a lot of money.
Right.
But, of course, the rule of investing is if you don't understand it, don't buy it. And, of course, a lot of people who bought those tech stocks they didn't really understand ended up losing their shirt. Between early 2000 and late 2002, the broad market fell about 50%, but those tech stocks fell around 80%. I mean, It really was a huge crash for the technology sector, and people who bought stuff they didn't really understand paid a heavy price.
Speaking of not understanding and the mania around a product, do you find that that's what happened with Bitcoin?
I think Bitcoin was a classic example of a bubble. I mean, I don't think a lot of people really understood the economics of cryptocurrencies and certainly didn't understand blockchain technology, but they bought simply because others were buying. It was a classic mania, and I think when the histories are written, the hoopla over Bitcoin in 2017 will receive a lot of prominence. People were buying simply because others were buying, and they thought it was going to go up.
Thanks, Jonathan. That is Jonathan Clements, personal finance expert, also founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for joining us. Storytelling is supposed to be a bonding experience. When we share our personal narratives, we disclose something about our values, our history, our outlook on life. The self-disclosure builds closeness and is a signal of faith in the relationship. But as Wall Street Journal columnist Elizabeth Bernstein explains, the bonding benefits of storytelling only work if you're good at it. Elizabeth, what are the good and bad of storytelling?
Good and bad of storytelling. The good is storytelling is really important to us. It's a bonding experience. When we share our personal narratives, like we're sharing a lot about ourselves, our values, our history, our outlook on life. We're like telling the other person sort of who we are. And this is a really important thing. And also, scientists study what happens in our brain when we're telling stories, and our brain's releasing certain chemicals, and the chemicals it is releasing are bonding chemicals, primary pain chemicals that focus our attention and chemicals that bond us. So storytelling is an excellent thing for us to be doing with other people. The problem is many people are not good at it, right? So not that's good storytelling does all that thing. Bad storytelling annoys and bores people. So I looked at, how can you be a good storyteller and, what do we do wrong and what should we do better?
All right, so start with that. What makes for a good storytelling?
So good storytelling is, again, the scientists sort of have looked at how we pay attention, what sort of gets us interested and hooked of a story. And the elements, it doesn't matter what the story is. You could have, taken your child to kindergarten and something interesting happened that morning, or you could have caught a fish, or, the proverbial, I caught this fish, whatever it is. It doesn't matter what the story's about, but all good stories sort of share these elements. And one is, they call it a hot open, very exciting opening. Think of like James Bond. He never like opens in a coffee shop and just sits there and reads his book. Like he's off doing something, so very exciting. He's chasing the bad guy. So you want a hot open, and then you build this emotion and the tension. You want to have good characters. All good stories have very good characters that are likable. You care about them, but also something's going to happen to them, and there's some tension, and there's some action, and then there's a very satisfying resolution, right? That's key to a good story.
What makes for a bad story?
So bad story, or maybe even a bad story has none of those things, but also bad storytelling, like people do these same things over and over, and they repeat their stories. Like, let me tell you about this story. Great, Grandpa, like we've heard this one before, right? They tell tales that don't have a point. They sort of, weave all over the place. And, if your listener is too busy trying to figure out what you're actually talking about, they're never going to, they're never going to be engaged in your story if they have no idea what's going on. People don't pay attention to their audience. They'll just tell their favorite story. They're not paying attention to, this is inappropriate to tell these people. They're not going to like this, they don't pay attention to what their listeners accuse. Like maybe my listener just fell asleep or yawned or whatever the cues are. They just keep going. They're going to, and they ramble. So that's bad storytelling for you.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Wall Street Journal columnist Elizabeth Bernstein. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. The Masters, as you know, is one of the most unusual events in sports. It's all about tradition, and it's defined by a set of odd rules and customs. Business Insider compiled the oddest ones that make the Masters and Augusta one of its kind. Number one, food prices are ridiculously low. Egg salad sandwich, just $1.50. Number two, tickets are dirt cheap, only $250, but for a four-day pass. But you, of course, have to win a lottery to buy them. Number three, only 4 minutes of commercials per hour are allowed on the TV broadcast. Number four, you can't even apply to be a member at Augusta. You have to be nominated by a current member. And new invites generally are not accepted unless someone quits or dies. Membership is right around 300. Number five, Augusta is closed in the summer to keep the course in pristine shape. And number six, the bunkers at Augusta are filled with mining waste. They're actually composed of waste product from the mining of aluminum. Basically, there's this company that mines certain rocks for aluminum, and this process produces waste in the form of really bright, pure quartz, and that's what Augusta uses. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news! There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.